come up on tight
wire. I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, and I have a surprise for you today. We have a co-host, and her name is Nancy Lechuga. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, you know, we have great conversations, so I figured you'd make a good co-host to stand in today while we talk to Juan Ochoa, whose new book, Marijuana, just came out. We're very excited about that. And for the poem of the week, what are you going to read today?
This week I'm going to read three poems from this really good Russian poet that I discovered recently. Her name is Vera Pavlova. Just something a little different.
Well, welcome to the show. I'm really glad you're joining us. Tell us a little bit about you for people who don't know you. You're a poet.
Yes, I'm a local poet. Just, you know, I'm a poet and a mother. That's pretty much my main role right now.
And you're a very good poet. I've read a lot of your poems, and I really admire your work. And you know what? You and I are Facebook friends, and I love your posts about your kids. You love being a mother.
Yes, I really do. I really love being a mother. They take up most of my time, and I'm really, really happy. So a lot of my poetry centers around motherhood and womanhood and just pretty much what I'm going through at the moment. And
you know, it's beautiful about your experiences with as being a mother and your poetry and the posts that you put on Facebook is it's as if you're discovering being a mother entirely by yourself, just you and your two kids, and you're learning things as you go. You don't have somebody there really consulting you on how to be a mother.
Yes, and the great thing about spending so much time with children, because I work with children. My degree's in education, and I work a lot with children, and it's just such a gift to be able to spend time with them, and they really give you a perspective on humanity, because that's as raw as you're going to get. And they really do help in my analysis of people and just humanity in general. And I explore that and use it in my poetry.
Give me an example of one of the things your kids might have observed that it caused you to see something differently. Because I think that's kind of where how it feeds into your poetry, right? Kids see such stuff in just amazing ways. And then we kind of see it and go, wow, they're right.
Yes, I'm always really amazed because children have such literal wisdom. You know, they're discovering the world, and sometimes we might overlook something because it's just we take it for granted, and it's just looking at the world in a new way, in a very just looking at the world in a positive light and with a lot of optimism.
With wonder.
With wonder. Yes, yeah. With wonder, definitely. And just every day is just such an adventure. And I'm just really lucky. So, because I don't have a lot of time to write, obviously. They're very small. They're 2.5 and 1 year old.
Wow, yeah. So you're constantly busy watching one and then watching the other and then watching them both at the same time.
Yeah, but it's material. You know, maybe I don't have time to actually write it down on paper, but I'm gaining all of this insight And it's really good. I think it just makes me a more well-rounded person to have that experience.
Absolutely. And you know, one of my favorite quotes, I tell my students this all the time. I love this quote. It's everybody's a genius until they're 7 years old. And so you are surrounded by geniuses, and that can't help but help your poetry.
and your
development as a human, you know. So awesome. I'm so glad to have you on the show. We're very good friends, and I thought you would be great to help me co-host today. So stick around. Nancy and I are going to talk to Juan Ochoa, author of the new book, Marijuana.
On today's show, we're having Juan Ochoa with his new book, Marijuana. Juan Ochoa is licensed to practice law in his beloved Mexico. Ochoa has been everything from pistolero to professor and is currently teaching English at South Texas College. He lives happily with his wife and daughter in Mission, Texas on Inspiration Road.
Juan Ochoa, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you're calling in from where are you at right now?
We're in the Rio Grande Valley, South Texas. We're literally on the border with Mexico and Texas.
Yeah, which is where your novel takes place, Marijuana.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, my novel is set on the Texas-Mexico border, mainly between the Mexican town of Reynosa and the American town of McAllen. And the characters, for one reason or another, you know, they switch back and forth from the two borders, from the Dos Fronteras.
Yeah, and you, we'll get into your life versus the life of El Johnny, your character in Marijuana. He's the main character. He's a young man whose father is involved in the drug business, shall we say, and becomes more involved.
By now, it's no secret. My father had a lot of notoriety between the different law enforcement agencies on both sides of the river and within the narco underworld. Like I said, you know, you can't say that he was famous. He was more notorious. My dad,
good distinction.
Yeah. My dad acted as the liaison between the authorities and anybody who was trying to pass a load north or bring a load from the north to the south, because, you know, there is a lot of contraband that flows from the United States to Mexico that people are just ignore. They just assume that, you know, it's only coming from the south up to the north, and it's not like that at all.
Well, you know, I was going to kind of try to, you know, get you to be, you know, comfortable with us and then eventually ask you how autobiographical it was, but man, you just shot right into it. How autobiographical is this?
No shame in my game. No. If God knows, let everybody else know too.
It's a compelling story, man. About
what I do try to do, Daniel, and what you were asking me originally, you know, how much El Johnny and Juan Ochoa are the same. A lot of the attributes that are given to El Johnny are made up of different characters that I've met over my life. So, and I ball them all up into this one central character of El Johnny because, well, when you're writing a book of this nature and that deals with such a delicate matter and with such violent outcomes that and this, you know, unwritten code of etiquette, you know, when it comes to talking about these things, I didn't want anybody to be put out in the light like, okay, this is the guy who did it, or this is the guy who said it, or anything like that. And I felt if any blame or if anybody was going to point an accusatory finger, well, let them do it to me, because ultimately I'm the one that's telling the story. But, you know, actually, you know, El Johnny, the Don Julio character, all the characters are a makeup of a lot of different people that we meet along our lives, right?
Right.
And they, for one reason or another, they made an impression, and I try to highlight those impressions in the actions and the words of these characters.
Right. You know, that makes a lot of sense. When you write fiction, a lot of times you write a character that may be very near somebody, like in my novel.
Mm-hmm.
The father was very near, like my father. But it's a composite. It's not
sure.
Just the father. That may be, you know, the inspiration, but there's a lot of other people that occupy that character. Because a character in fiction, and this is a difference between fiction and nonfiction, a character in fiction has to have room to grow beyond what the initial ideas of the writer are.
Definitely. You can't stay static. They have to evolve, and they have to come, you know, full circle. Or if not, the writing has to be done in such a way where you're going to stifle that character, and it's going to be known, and there's a purpose for that too, I think. But in this case, like I said, I wanted to develop a raw look at the border life and the nautical scene and just in general growing up in a region that's plagued by a vicious cycle of crime and poverty, that I wanted to make sure that I captured aspects of several and not just concentrated on one.
And, you know, this is kind of funny because, you know, I read this book even before it came out because, you know, I blurbed it. And I, you know, was going over it again today, but it was just now in the studio when it occurred to me, Juan Ochoa, El Johnny, duh.
You know, and that's always been a little pet peeve of mine, because when I went to school in America, first day of school, without fail, they'd be going over the roll, and as soon as they got to Juan Ochoa, they would exit out and write down John or Johnny, you know? and in my house, when I was growing up with my siblings and my mom and my dad, that's what they would call me, El Johnny, El Johnny, El Johnny. People in Mexico, when I studied over there, El Johnny, El Johnny, El Johnny, El Johnny, El Johnny. So, you know, I was baptized Juan. I, you know, was registered as Juan. And it's only here in America, after my second trip back, and mostly it's Anglos who will only refer to me by my given name, Juan Ochoa.
That's
everybody else is Johnny,
wow.
Johnny. And I, you know, and I tried so hard all my life to get away from that and to find an identity and to, you know, all that good stuff that we're supposed to, you know, every good Chicano is supposed to go through. And I just said, nah. Might as well just embrace it.
Yeah, and so using the name Al Johnny in itself, it kind of has more meaning to you than just
sure,
if you would have
sure.
chose Doug. You know,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's a good thing your name wasn't Jesus, and
right?
Said, hey, Jesus.
Then I'd be El Chewy, and they'd confuse me with some kind of Star Wars figure or something.
It does have more character, though, El Johnny.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think so, and like I said, I think it makes up. You know, in the States, we have the term, you know, Johnny come lately. You know, Johnny Rebel and stuff like that. Well, El Johnny kind of like, you know, for the border region also does make up a composite of a lot of the Mexican-American, Pocho, you know, whatever you want to call it, Spanglish-speaking individuals.
Right. And just the term Johnny itself has become an American term for the average kid. Why can't Johnny read?
Yeah, exactly.
And,
exactly.
Yeah, and one of the brilliant things about that movie, Godfather, which you can't help but evoke anytime you're writing about a family that's involved
sure.
in crime and
yeah, sure.
the underworld. But one of the brilliant things about it is how violent they were and how there were really no limits when it came to, you know, to fighting their enemies and the, you know, the length they would go to. Yet the family was so conservative,
mm-hmm.
so religious and so traditional. There's an element of that in this novel. The family is, you know, involved in incredible things, yet there's still a very traditional Mexican family structure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, the thing that always blew my mind was that, you know, when my father would take his walks on the shady side of the street, you know, he'd have no problem whatsoever for me to run errands for him or to help him sell this or to connect this deal or something like that. But if he would catch me, you know, coming home late, cigarette smoke on my clothes, or, you know, heaven forbid that you know, he should catch me high or smoking a joint or something like that. I mean, there was all kinds of hell to pay. And I'd ask him, what's the deal? He says, you know, why can I help you sell this stuff, but I can't, you know, smoke it? You know, what's the problem there? And he's saying, you know, well, one thing is business and another thing is ruining your life, you know, and I don't want you to ruin your life. And I'm like, well, gee, you know, you couldn't have taught me another business. You
know? We're talking to Juan Ochoa, whose new book, Marihuano, just came out, and it's about a family of drug traffickers on the border in Reynoso in McAllen, Texas. And all the descriptions of this book say it's during the Reagan war on drugs. What is the difference between Reagan's war on drugs and the drug trafficking and the drug crimes that are going on then and what's been happening recently?
Well, you know, what Reagan basically did for the drug dealer was he took mom-and-pop operations, and because of Reagan's policy and because of their work down there with the Contras in Central and South America, and they took a bunch of mom-and-pop shop level drug dealers and turned them into Walmart. You know, literally turned them into Walmart. Reagan provided the infrastructure. Reagan, you know, provided the propaganda to raise the price on drugs. Reagan provided all kinds of raw material to turn this thing into a multi-billion-dollar worldwide network. You know, it used to be people would just be able to control little bits of regions of it, you know, your own little territory, your own little turf. You know, because we lived on the river, well, we could control the river, or we could control, you know, a town in the river, and by control I mean it was just that we knew who the local cops were and we knew who could pay off and stuff like that, and that was it. But with Reagan and opening up, you know, airstrips in South America and you know, getting treaties for airspace and building roads and things like that, support, giving, you know, supplies to law enforcement and the military, who would, you know, turn around and you know, the corruption would be there, and, you know, would turn around and turn over those same supplies, or, you know, deal with those supplies with the drug dealers and stuff like that. I mean, Reagan just opened the door for everybody.
So by creating an infrastructure for the war on drugs,
sure.
that infrastructure was used by the drug smugglers themselves.
Yeah, big time. And, I, you know, the thing about it is that every time I see that they're building a new road or every time that I find out that people start complaining like, oh, you know, we can't use this highway anymore, you know, because it's gotten too hot, or we can't, you know, go through this state because, you know, they've got too much law enforcement or anything like that. Miraculously, out of the heaven falls some international plan now to where they're going to build a highway straight from Colombia all the way to Canada. And it's like, wow, you know, but that sure solved, you know, scratch that itch, right? We're able to get over that. And, you know, and it just does that. And that's what Americans need to see, that every time that there's a problem with the steady flow of monies or drugs in and out of America, it's usually the government who steps up to solve this problem and not the drug dealer.
You know, that's interesting because I was just in McAllen, Hidalgo County, driving around with you. You were showing me around. In fact, I took some pictures of you and people. If you want to go on soychacon.blogspot.com, you can see pictures of Juan and where he showed me in Hidalgo County. But one of the things that you pointed out is how many cops there were. There were cops everywhere.
Everywhere.
And we were driving by the border, and we even got pulled over. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't doing anything, but they just by the fact of being there, they pulled us over.
Yeah.
And they came up with some stupid excuse. They said that you were speeding, and you said, well, I slowed down when I saw you, which made everybody laugh, including the cop. But the police presence there is so amazing, and they're everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. So is it different now?
No. But the thing about it is that, you know, we'll have this flood of law enforcement come down here, and they'll work and they'll set up their checkpoints and they'll, you know, write their tickets and they'll make their arrests and they'll make their busts. But what the authorities don't understand, that each and every one of those guys gets off of work sooner or later. And when they get off of work, they go and they sit at a bar, they go and, you know, barbecue with a neighbor or something like that. And people get to talking, and people get to buying each other drinks and stuff like that. And you know, CBS did a report not too long ago talking about how most people who smoke marijuana and have friends who are cops still smoke in front of their cop friends. And the usual response is, you know, I would do it too if it was legal, or if I wasn't subject to random drug tests, I would do it too. And anytime you get into a situation like that where you're doing something illegal, and even if it's something very minor, like a cop, you know, watching you smoke a joint or something like that, or, you know, while he's off duty, right there, that is the key for corruption to enter. Right, so these guys are coming down here, setting up their roadblocks. But in the evening, they're bellying up to the bar at the watering hole, and all you need is some guy there to, you know, buy a few drinks, and then next thing you know, the words are flowing out of the cop's mouth. Hey, if there's anything you ever need, and that's it. There it goes. Now you got another. Instead of having, you know, a tool to work against crime, now you have another accomplice, and that's what ends up happening. You know. They send National Guard down here. 6 months later, they're corrupt. They name a new police chief. A few months later, they either resign or they're caught, you know, for corruption charges. And unfortunately, that's what happens. They send us all this law enforcement, but instead of giving them a decent salary, they place a man with a pauper salary to guard a $1 billion industry. You know, it's just a recipe for failure.
But
they're down here and they're, you know, stopping us at every turn. And, you know, if our windows are tinted too dark, if we're following too close, we're following too far back, we're driving too fast, we're driving too slow, we swerved,
I've seen weirder and more high-tech cop equipment my 2 days there than I've ever seen in my life. And I live in the border, but there was this one that we stopped at a Walgreens to get a bottle of water, and there was this big contraption on legs. It looked like a giant futuristic robot, and on the top,
it looked like one of those things out of Star Wars, right?
Yeah, and everywhere there.
Yeah.
Is there maybe a connection to what's happening now in Juarez? Does it connect somehow?
Sure. That was the whole intention. What I was trying to show is how this drug war got started, and what ended up happening was, well, you get, you know, like I said, Reagan sets up the infrastructure. He makes the airstrips and the roads and everything like that. Then Clinton comes in and ushers through NAFTA, which was a Reagan-Bush concept to begin with, right? And it just happened to be signed under Clinton, and but what basically what you what, like I said, what happened was a few mom and pop level drug dealers suddenly became Walmart, and they were in direct complicity with Mexican and American authorities, and now you've only got a few guys working, and the rest of the nation is starving. And well, what's going to happen is this violence that we have, right? Everybody keeps on saying, you know, they're fighting over the turf, they're fighting over the routes, they're fighting over... No, man. You cannot have organized crime. The very definition, the very nature of organized crime is that you have to have complicity with the authorities. You have to have the authorities bought off. So what they're fighting for is who gets to pay off the authorities so they can, you know, ensure their loads can go by.
The book is amazing. And
Thank you.
What's your plan?
If people could just get it in front of them and read through it and see that, you know, the same thing that happened with alcohol prohibition is happening with drug prohibition, that, you know, all it does is a hotbed for corruption and to spur more illegal activities while it's draining our resources, hurting our economy, busting up families, you know, just creating a vicious cycle of broken families. Mm-hmm. When, you know, we argue that that's the nucleus of our society, and yet we do everything in our power to make sure that kids are in foster care, moms and dads are in jail, you know, for buying something cheap and selling it expensive. I thought that was capitalism. I thought that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Well, it's definitely a fascinating novel, and we're glad to have you on the show. Thank you, Juan.
Thanks. Thanks, Daniel. I really appreciate you having me.
Today's poem of the week, I'm going to read three short poems by a Russian poet by the name of Vera Pavlova. Her poetry is very relatable. She has a lot of poetry about motherhood, and I like to believe she's my Russian equivalent. And this first poem is called, Am I Lovely? Of course. Am I lovely? Of course. Breathlessly, I taste the subtle compliment of a handmade caress. Chop me into tiny bits, caress and tame my soul, that godly swallow you love to no end. The next poem is called He Marked the Page with a Match. He marked the page with a match and fell asleep in mid-kiss, while I, a queen bee, in a disturbed hive stay up and buzz. Half a kingdom for a honey drop, half a lifetime for a tender word, his face, half turned, half past midnight, half past one. The next poem by Vera Pavlova is called I Am in Love, Hence Free to Live. I am in love, hence free to live, by heart, to ad lib as I caress. A soul is light when full, heavy when vacuous. My soul is light, she is not afraid to dance the agony alone. For I was born wearing your shirt. Will come from the dead with that shirt on. Those were three poems by Vera Pavlova.
Hi, my name is Jessica Ceballos. I am from Los Angeles, California, and I am a literary event coordinator. I host and curate three readings at Beyond Baroque in Venice, California. It's the Great Beyond on the third Sundays of the month. The other is the Bluebird Reading Series in Highland Park at the Avenue 50 Studio. That is the second Sunday of the month. And I also curate a reading called Poesía para la Gente, which takes poetry to public spaces that are non-traditional spaces, such as the Home Depot, the Metro, taco shop, and various other places. So for my poetic license, I've decided to do an interview, and I'm going to be interviewing Chi-Wan Choi. He's a writer, author of Abductions, published by Tietuchas, and The Flood, published by Writ Large Press. He's also a publisher, editor, and partner at Writ Large Press, and he's a partner of a performance microspace alchemist laboratory, a bookstore hidden in the last bookstore in downtown L.A. It's called DT Lab. The reason why I'm interviewing him is because his latest book, It Was Always the Weight of Everything, that he's currently writing, He started writing the book once the Facebook page hit 500 likes. It took a matter of days to get to that number, and now I think it's at like 750 and climbing. And his promise is to complete the book in 2 weeks and then digitally publish it, making it available free of charge. And I think to say this is an experiment in publishing is an understatement. It's a social media experiment. It's an experiment in writing. And a lot of us were taught that you don't write for the audience, but this premise is kind of born of an audience. And Tuan is a tremendously effective writer. I'd like to see what happens when a really good writer connects to an audience during the process of book writing. So Tuan, you're writing this book right now. Is it having an effect on your writing process that you're consciously aware of?
Yes, it is. It's stressing me out greatly. Yeah, I didn't really think about how stressed I would be about the fact that a bunch of people are now, like, I have publicly promised them I'm going to have a book for them in a matter of days.
So did you put an outline for it, or is it just a cold writing process?
I have no outline. I thought I would have a few more weeks of prep time. I didn't realize it would hit 500 likes so fast. It's been very interesting.
And then as far as the publishing concept, I think we know how it fits into the current publishing culture, but how does it not fit in? I think that's like the key. Like, how is it different than, it's free, right? But I mean, it's an e-book. It'll be an e-book, basically, but it's free, which
right.
is a little different.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a couple of main things I wanted to experiment with is not only just, I wanted to sort of compress the time between the creation of the artwork and when the public sees it. So a lot of the times when you write a book, even after you sell the book, by the time the book comes out, it's been like 2-3 years, you know what I mean?
Right.
I wanted to see what it's like when you write a book and within a month people are already giving you feedback on it.
Writing the book too, right? Because you're also, aren't you like publishing little on Facebook, little like excerpts?
Well, the Facebook stuff was completely separate. I think this was just the evolution of what I was doing on Facebook, just writing on Facebook. The other thing I was thinking about that came up from doing all those Facebook writing is I wanted to see what happens if I write something and release it as totally public domain,
right?
Like, so people could do whatever they want with it.
So it's public domain. You can copyright it. You can grab like excerpts of it and do something with it. And
yeah, and you could actually decide that you want to publish a physical copy of the book, and you could go ahead and do it and sell it.
There you go. And I think by the time that this airs, like, it'll be out. Cool. So you can get it on the Facebook page, which I think is like Facebook.com. It was always the weight of everything, right?
Yeah.
And also, I don't know if you have like a benefactor paying you to write this book. But it takes time to write. Did you secretly like get a grant for $10 million or something?
No, I wish. I wish.
It's an awesome project, so I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, and good luck.
Thank you.
So, thank you so much, Tuan. So I've been talking to Tuan Choi, publisher, editor, writ large press, partner at DT Lab, and we've been talking about his book, It Was Always the Weight of Everything. And it's available online at writlargepress.com, or you can find it at Facebook. If you just type it in the search engine, and it should be available free of charge and public domain. For Words on a Wire, I am Jessica Ceballos.
Thank you for listening to Words on a Wire. We want to thank Juan Ochoa.
And we'd like to thank you, Nancy, for not only co-hosting for the very first time, but also for reading those lovely poems and for introducing me to a new poet.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for inviting me.
And we'd like to thank our very hardworking producer, Norma Martinez. None of this would be possible without her. And join us every week on Words on a Wire. And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circle.